We stand for African people in the South because we have been the brunt of oppression and at the bottom level of oppression for so long. But at the same time, we understand that our way up is everybody's way up. That's what it is, right? Our way up is everybody's way up.
That's Chokwe Lumumba, the former mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. Lumumba died in February 2014, less than 1 year after the veteran civil rights organizer and attorney was elected in a landslide.
Folks say down in Mississippi, some of them, that I'm too radical. Right? And I remind them that Fannie Lou Hamer was radical. Right? I remind them that Mega Evers was radical. Right? And that Martin Luther King was radical. Right? So being radical, we have to understand that one of the things that happens is that whenever you're for change, that causes controversy. And when you get involved in controversy, then that's what they call radical, right? So we don't step back from controversy. We don't step back from change. This is our time. This is a very important time.
Chokwe Lumumba was one of hundreds of social justice advocates and organizers who passed away in 2014, leaving behind their work as their legacy, but often also leaving an irreplaceable hole in their movements. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and on today's edition of Making Contact, we honor and revisit the lives of just a few of those fallen heroes who passed away this year.
So we walk through an urbanized Bronx today, but recognize that back in the 1600s and 1700s, the Bronx was largely wetlands and forests. So if we were standing here in 1800, we would be surrounded by vast oak hickory forests with massive trees that we only have a few of today, which were common then.
My name is Dr. Mark Nason. I'm a professor of African American Studies and History at Fordham University in the Bronx. I remember Morgan Powell vividly because about 3 years after we started the Bronx African American History Project, he came up to me and said, I want to really help you in this project, but I want to expand the range of what it's doing to include the Bronx parks, waterways, and rivers. I'm very interested, he told me, in how Bronx African American history was connected to the natural environment of the Bronx, which had been, you know, sorely neglected.
You know what, I'm 38 years old. My generation was told the Bronx is not beautiful. If you have the resources to move out, it's a place you want to leave. But that was a fallacy. What happened? A lot of us who have the resources move up to the Catskills, can't afford it, you know, and now we're back in the Bronx or elsewhere. We're scattered. We should have stayed here. Those of us who are here now, stay here, build the Bronx, see the beauty around you. And these places are gorgeous. The Bronx is gorgeous.
He did this all on his own, and he found out amazing information going back to the 18th century about African Americans who lived along the Bronx River or along the waterfront on the East River. And then he started doing something even more incredible. He started organizing community tours of the Bronx River. He called the tours the Bronx River Sankofa. And they were free. And hundreds of people went on these tours.
What happens in a place like this, which was a plantation right here in the Bronx at a time before the Erie Canal, which wasn't open until the 1820s, grain has to be produced locally because America in the early days doesn't have much infrastructure. So the economical way for New York families to eat is to buy locally grown food. And one of the many places in the region where space is available to grow food is right here on the Bronx River, stretching back toward Morris Park and the Van Ness communities.
Most people who do scholarship now are in universities. He was a professional gardener doing absolutely frontline research and present and doing public history. So he made a tremendous impact on large numbers of people, giving them a sense of pride and ownership in where they live. and making people who lived in the Bronx, who were African-American, Latino, really proud of their history and proud of their communities. I cannot think of an independent scholar that I knew who had a greater impact than Morgan Powell did.
In November of 1977, two men running a hot dog stand in the north side of Chicago were robbed at gunpoint, shot, and killed execution style. A short time later, a man named Darby Tillis was arrested, tried, and convicted in the murders. He was given the death penalty. After spending 9 years on death row, it turned out Mr. Tillis was innocent. He was released from prison and has devoted his life trying to abolish the death penalty.
So a song is called Killing Flow Death Row.
My name is Terry Cobb, the co-defendant of Darby Tillis.
My name is Darby Tillis. I spent 9 years, 1 month, and 17 days on death row for a crime I did not commit. I was tried 5 times more than anyone in the history of the United States judicial system, including 3 hung juries.
We had 5 trials together, was tried more times than anyone in the history of the United States judiciary system. I remember a special thing came up that he had to fire an attorney. And I drew up the document. And I told him, I said, when you read this, just start to read it, and everyone is going to be quiet and listen to you. Just to say that the let the record reflect. And he did that. When he finished reading it, he said, P. He said, man, he said, well, this is just like the hand of God had the court to be quiet. I said, yeah, that's right. That's right. I remember when he did that, he had a sparkle in his eye because he had did that. That was a home run, and that was a good thing.
My judge is now doing 15 years in the federal penitentiary. Bless his heart.
All the other times that we was in the county jail and on death row, he was his own man like I am my own man. He did what he wanted to do, and I did what I thought was best for me. And that's what time it is with Darby Tillis and I. I've always known him as to be an upstanding person. And that's all I can say. I can't say anything bad about it. He's a good man. Sorry he passed.
From my window, I can see the Mississippi. Upon my face, feel teardrops dripping. Late at night, afraid of passing by. Down the gallery, hear an inmate cry. Killing flow, death row. Killing flow, death row. Go ahead, Scotty.
I am Lila Cabell. I'm President Emeritus of the Rosa Parks Institute and a founding member, along with Charity, of the People's Water Board. I've had a long-term relationship with Charity Hicks. She was active in doing the research and coordination to establish in Detroit the first Food Policy Council, and she also was a founding member of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network.
Detroit leadership see us all as victims. They view us as statistics. They view us as the marginalized. Well, we're much more than that. We're human beings.
Charity's last work was around water as a human right, and what does that mean?
We got a major city, a hub city, with whole segments of the community with zero access to water, fresh water. The irony of it. It's like, I went to one meeting, and one of the water engineers for the water board told me, if you want water for free, go to the creek and fetch it. So I was like, wow. And I actually took that, you know, it was honest. And they were mad because they claimed that human rights people, like our language, our rhetoric, and our campaigns, it's like a freeloading. You're freeloading. We're not asking to freeload. We're asking for dignity. We're not asking for either or. We're asking for both and. Can we have access? Can it be affordable? And at the same time, how do we constructively pay for our infrastructure?
Charity's way of doing her work was very much inclusive and addressing people at a grassroots level who were challenged by the system.
Because we can't continue to deny people water. We just can't. It's a sanitation, it's a health, it's all types of things wrapped up in it. If you don't have running water, it's a form of neglect on children, minor children. It exacerbates health conditions. It's also a human dignity thing.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to donate, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. And now, back to honoring more fallen heroes of 2014. First up, this remembrance of Yuri Kochiyama, produced by Y.E. Lee.
Yuri Kochiyama, freedom fighter, after 93 summers, has become an ancestor.
On February 12, 1965, in the Audubon Ballroom, Yuri Kochiyama cradled Malcolm X in her arms as he lay dying. But her life working for justice began much earlier than this pivotal public moment. She was born Mary Yuriko Nakahara on May 19, 1921. Yuri grew up in San Pedro, California, where the events of World War II and the bombing of Pearl Harbor by Japan changed the lives of many, including Yuri and her family. On the morning of December 7, 1941, Yuri's father was detained and interrogated and returned home, only to die the day after. From the documentary Passion for Justice, she says that,
When I was like 20 years old, I was totally apolitical. And I did not see anything in a political way. It took me a long time before I came to the political stage.
As a result of Executive Order 9066, Yuri and her family were ordered to the concentration camps at Jerome, Arkansas, where she spent 2 years.
Executive Order 9066.
As Yuri reflects in her memoir, Passing It On, what happened to Japanese Americans after the bombing of Pearl Harbor marked the beginning of her political awakening and development. It was in the camps where she met and fell in love with her late husband, Bill Kochiyama. They later married and had 6 children.
This was the beginning of our new life to be. We would soon experience Harlem in the 60s, during the hottest decade up north for civil rights, the sizzling 60s.
In 1963, she met Malcolm X in a courtroom. And in June of 1964, Malcolm X even came by the Kochiyama's Harlem apartment, where they hosted a reception for atom bomb survivors. Then on February 21, 1965, Yuri and her son Billy witnessed his assassination. In the film, Death of a Prophet, she talks about those final moments.
When I got to him, well, he had fallen over backward, but he was flat on his back. I could see that he was hit many times. I thought there was only one or two shots, but it seemed like there were he already had so many wounds around his chest.
Saw the first man with the shotgun. Two more came to get the job done. Now who would have thought that it'd be you holding him? I wonder what you felt when his eyes were going dim. And if
if he never died, would we know that he exists?
After Malcolm's assassination, he started working with the groups that emerged to carry on Malcolm's vision, including the Republic of New Africa. She worked in the Asian American movement, the Puerto Rican movement. I mean, she's really a bridge builder. But the movement that has been dearest to her heart is the political prisoner movement. So she's been working for some six decades very consistently as an activist, really nonstop, and has influenced generations and generations of activists from the 60s to the present.
That was the voice of Diane Fugino, the author of Heartbeat of Struggle, The Revolutionary Life of Yuri Kochiyama, from a tribute segment on Freedom Now. Yuri moved to Oakland in 1999 and spent the last 15 years of her life in the Bay Area, where she continued her movement work, showing up at anti-war marches, rallies, and meetings in a walker. And of course, she continued her lifelong support work for political prisoners and even politicized prisoners. Here's Tayo Na from the piece Yuri, Tupac, and a Harlem House, which appeared in Hyphen Magazine.
As we continue to memorialize Yuri, it is vital to not see her as a flash in the pan, but water in a never-ending river for justice, for the next generations especially, to connect the dots between Kendrick Lamar, Pac, Malcolm, and Yuri. She herself would have made the transnational political connections occurring in today's world, from Gaza to Ferguson, generationally between Emmett Till to Mike Brown, Vincent Chin to Renisha McBride, Mumia to Snowden, white supremacy and imperialism to neoliberalism. The spirit of Yuri is in our interconnectedness. Yuri Kochiyama, eternally presente.
That piece was produced by Y.E. Lee.
We saved rent control! Yahoo!
My name is Randy Shaw. I'm the director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic in San Francisco. I first began working with Ted Gullickson in 1992 on what became the first winning tenant ballot measure in San Francisco. And then I worked really intensely with Ted from 92, probably for the next, 15 to 20 years. He was central to absolutely every citywide tenant campaign.
We're looking for new and big ideas for the ballot, and we want to develop an entire legislative agenda. We know we can't wait until November 2014, but what we want on the ballot then is something that's really big, something that would be difficult to pass through City Hall, something that's radical, and all these meetings are in the hopes that we will get that from the people.
I think it gets back to what's happening in urban America across the country, where increasingly it's becoming more and more expensive to live. So how do you keep cities like San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles, Seattle, Chicago, how do you keep them diverse, economically diverse? And many cities have failed. We've been more successful in San Francisco despite tremendous pressure, and Ted played a critical role in passing ballot measures and legislation to protect tenants from the risks of speculators and displacement. We also fought off measures to weaken rent control. There were a number of very well-funded landlord attacks on rent control, and we defeated all of them. And Ted was a key player, designing literature, doing the campaign apparatus. He was the sort of key tenant political figure for a long time.
California really hates 98. Prop 98 is going down statewide big time. Yeah! Almost by a margin of 2-1. It's going to be over 20 points. We will see rent control saved in California. And we're going to turn this into a huge victory, because now we can go to all our elected officials and we can say strongly now that California strongly supports rent control, and do something about that in Sacramento.
Well, Ted's badly missed, and it's always popular to say that, oh, no one's irreplaceable and we're moving on, but the tenants movement in San Francisco has suffered a major loss which will not be easily replaced. There's not going to be another Ted Gullickson.
My name is Cassine Davis. I'm a program manager here at Kids Rethink New Orleans Schools based in New Orleans, Louisiana. I met George Carter in 2011 during our Rethink Summer Institute program. What I will always remember about George is his ability to always carry a smile.
Hello, my name is George Carter and I am a rethinker.
The work that George was doing, you know, definitely fits into a national context, especially looking at the current political climate.
I'm here to tell you about standardized testing and how it is affecting my school by causing my classmates to drop out or even go to jail. You probably heard of the student dropout rate caused by the school-to-prison pipeline, but I'm here to give you the real story, the test-to-prison pipeline.
So this is something that he lived through his work with fighting the school-to-prison pipeline, was working with, you know, national organizations like the Alliance for Educational Justice, as well as here locally with his peers and being a part of the Rethink Organizing Collective, which was all about galvanizing youth voice and action to create, you know, change on a systemic level, but also providing a space where they can, you know, elicit and utilize their own agency and power, knowing that this is a national conversation. This is also something that's historical and generational.
With the test of the prison pipeline, the current amount of high-stake testing forced teachers to teach to the test. The problem with that is everybody had to learn on one level. So let's say I'm lagging behind in math. So that means I have to move harder to move up. If I have to work harder, I'm gonna get stressed. If I get stressed, I won't be able to do my work. I'll probably flunk class or drop out of school. If I drop out of school, I'm gonna be on the streets. If I'm on the streets, I'm gonna be homeless, dead, or in prison.
His work that he was involved in was all about being recognized as a human, as a black youth in the United States. And so that's what he worked towards, was being treated and receiving the same, you know, equitable rights as every other human being and having the opportunity to live a full life without, you know, being demonized, criminalized. And wanted to see that, you know, not just a matter of when people lose their lives, but also the everyday micro and macro aggressions that do occur to young people of color, especially young black folks.
To our knowledge, there are only two schools in New Orleans that have support teams. But the Rethinkers want all schools in New Orleans to have support teams.
If we can learn anything from this, is also understanding how we value black life. And it just doesn't have to be a matter of the loss of life. It has to be the everyday, you know, experiences that young people deal with, young black people, and black people overall. And, you know, that's something that George fought for was being able to be alive and not just living. But I'm not speaking out of turn when I say he wants us to continue that fight, wants us to continue to question the world around us, but in a way that allows for us to be productive and also be real about it, that we are facing some egregious injustices. We are facing, you know, this historical and generational acts of violence against black people and people of color and marginalized youth overall. And in order for us to rise up against this, we have to continue to align and call it when we see it and not try to sweep it under the rug, because that's something a judge would not do.
The missing ingredient in the criminal justice system is justice.
My name is Dr. Divine Pryor. I'm the executive director of the Center for New Leadership on Urban Solutions. Well, what I always remember about Eddie is that his thoughtfulness about issues, that Eddie spent a lot of time closely examining and assessing issues in a very holistic way.
The prison industrial complex is working well. It's alive and well. It's about commerce. It's about profit. It's about private prisons. It's about the coming together of government and law enforcement and the academic community and the corporate community to use this so-called justice system as an engine to drive profit.
And we decided that one should not be referred to by the worst thing that happened in their life. That people in prison were simply that, they were people. And so we began to insist that we refer to people in prison as incarcerated people, as people who've been convicted of crimes, people who have made mistakes, people who deserve a second chance, but people, because we wanted to rehumanize a population that had been dehumanized through language.
The idea that people who have substance abuse issues should be treated in a public health context, that we should be moving from punishment to treatment, is one of the major elements that's missing in the criminal justice system. It is, in fact, restorative justice.
And so Eddie would often be heard saying that this is not a prison problem, that this is a community problem, and that a part of his analysis is that if, in fact, we're going to address issues in the prison, then we certainly have to address issues and conditions in the communities where the large majority of individuals are coming from.
This prison industrial complex has become so insidious that it has swallowed up whole communities, and in the process has destroyed both the economic, the political, and the moral fabric of those communities.
That's it for this special edition of Making Contact, celebrating the fallen heroes of 2014. Tell us about your fallen heroes on our website, radioproject.org, or on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. The Making Contact team includes Lisa Rudman, Quan Booth, George Lavender, Laura Flynn, and Jasmine Lopez. I'm Andrew Stelzer. We leave you today with the words of another fallen hero, transgender activist Leslie Feinberg.
I leave you with this thought. It's a good thing to talk about unity, but it's an even better thing to walk your talk. And I think that the way to really build solidarity between peoples who don't necessarily face identical oppressions and haven't worked together, and we need to build trust, this is how I think we should do it. I think each of us need to be the best fighters against each other's oppression. That's how we're really going to build trust. When you need me, I'll be there. See, we can say to each other, I will be with you on the front lines to fight racism. I will be there with you to fight immigrant scapegoating and anti-Semitism and woman-hating and gay-bashing. And I will vow to stand with you to fight shoulder to shoulder, not just to defend affirmative action, but to expand it, to win jobs and health care and housing and unemployment and education. And so that leaves back to each one of you a question that only you can answer, which is, when it is transgender lives on the line and transsexual lives and the lives of drag queens and drag kings and intersexuals, when it's our blood, when we're fighting for our right to live and work in dignity and respect, will each of you have the courage to stand with us and fight back against trans oppression? Thank you.
Making contact.